Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series.
You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Watch Hacks, streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look out. His only films to be buried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a neuroblocker, and I love film. As Charles Dickens once said, there is nothing in the world so irresistibly contagious as laughter and good humour. Also, the film Happy Gilmore is pretty fucking hard to dislike. That's true, Charles. That is true. Every week, I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died. Then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Kevin Smith, Sharon Stone, Jameela Jamil, James Acaster, and even Pred Campbell's. But this week, what a guest. It is the phenomenal genius that is Russell T. Davies. Get over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you'll get about an extra 25 minutes with Russell. We talk in depth about beginnings and endings. You get a secret from him. You can get the whole episode uncut and ad free and as a video. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Your two TV missions, as always, are to watch season 1 of Ted Lasso on the Apple TV Plus app and season 1 of Soulmates on Amazon Prime. One will make you happy, the other will make you question your relationships. So, Russell T. Davies, come on, what a legend. Russell T. Davies is responsible, I think, for at least 8 stone cold masterpieces of British TV. It's more. I mean, it is more. I'm trying to be like, you know, most people make like one incredible. It's incredible. His output is as extraordinary as it is prolific. He's a genuine hero. I think, you know, and people say it, but yeah, I think he is a genius. Don't tell him that. He's also bloody nice. And look, I'm going to be straight up with you. A lot of this episode is just me telling Russell how much I love him. You know what? I stand by it. He's fucking brilliant. I hope that you will love this episode too. We recorded it over a Zoom a couple of months ago. I've been very excited for you all to listen. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 149 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is me, Brett Goldstein, and I am joined today by an absolute hero, a legend, a writer, an executive producer, a creator. Genuinely, is he number one? I think he might be the greatest TV writer that we have had in this universe. Let's call it that. I cannot believe he's here. I love him with all my heart. Will you please welcome to the show the brilliant, the amazing, it's Russell T. Davies!
Hooray! That was my best piece of writing. I actually wrote that introduction.
And you banged it out in a minute, which is...
Yeah, easy.
I was very impressed. Russell, I've got so much more to talk to you about. Thank you for doing the show. Are you okay?
I am good, actually, yes. Thank you. Yes.
Good. I don't think I've been this giddy about being with a guest for a long time.
Can I say giddy? I think I'm like, I looked at your podcast, I'm like number 1,526. You've interviewed everyone in the world before getting around to me.
I think this is the very first time that you've not been working on 25 things all at once. I saw the window. I was like, hang on, he's doing a lot of interviews.
Was this just the first time I bothered to reply to an email?
One or the other.
It might be that.
Firstly, if you don't mind me saying this, I'm going to shower you with love. First thing I'll say is, you're a lovely man. And I'll tell you for why. And I found this genuinely extraordinary. I met you, I was doing Catherine Tate live show. You came to see it because of your love and friendship with Catherine Tate. We met deep after love. The show. You were very nice. We had a nice chat. You heard that Catherine and I had made this film, Super Bob. You said, I'll watch that. I thought, yeah, of course you won't. Not only did you watch it, you sent me an essay about it in which it was like a sort of creative writing essay on like why the plot did this, why this worked, all the stuff that you hope that someone will notice was going on in it. I couldn't believe it. It was so nice of you. I thought, what a very nice man. And that was just the beginning.
Thank you. I loved it.
Well, you're very kind. But do you know what I didn't know? Right, so basically, you're the most prolific and brilliant. I think in a way, it's even hard to talk about your stuff because most people have like a, well, then they did their masterpiece. But I was looking at your CV. It's all, they're all your masterpiece. I'd forgotten you did Second Coming. That's brilliant. I think about that a lot.
Do you know, I think I made that the wrong time. I should make that now. Yes. Imagine that on Netflix. Netflix with like $10 million per episode. Imagine the miracles and the crowds. Imagine the internet. He'd travel all over the world now. He'd go to Israel. He'd go to New York. It was truly in the wrong time, that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So can we talk a little bit about your brain? Because all of the shows you've done, Second Coming, the resurrecting, redoing Doctor Who, making it amazing, Years and Years, It's a Sin. They're all hugely amazing. Aside from all the things that are brilliant about them, there's so many ideas in all of these things. And in Doctor Who, every week you have a new philosophy, a new, you know, a whole. Is your brain constantly going blah 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 blah? Like, how does it work for you?
Actually, I think it is. And you're right, but I only kind of realized this recently. Like in the past 2 years, I thought everyone's brains were like that all the time. Like all the time. All the time. Yeah. And I am recently coming to terms with the fact that it isn't for most people. And I'm not saying that's clever. I'm not saying that's brainy. It's like, you know, there are people who are much better lovers than me, better friends, better. Well, there's about three people who are better lovers. Yeah. And
and I can, you name know,
I've had them. And, you know, it's just, I'm not saying it's a gift. I'm just saying it's just the way my brain is. But, you know, people say to you, why are you a writer? But it's just no choice because these stories and characters and dialogue, literally dialogue goes through my head all day long. All day long. When I come to writing a script, the dialogue takes about 10 seconds. I'm not kidding. I go like that because, and I'm good at dialogue because it's all just there. It's there. It's like it's ready. It's kind of downloading. It's a strange thing. I'm very lucky. So I'm in the right job, I think.
But is it ever exhausting? Is it ever like you can't, oh God, I can't sleep because there's voices and ideas? And,
oh, very much. Yeah. There's a new, I've got a new idea at the moment. And literally, I was tend to wake up at 5:30 and it's all boiling away and going ticky, 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 ticky. Nicola Schindler, who I produce an awful lot of stuff with, she's married to a writer, Matt Greenhouse, and she says writers never have holidays. Christmas Day or you're on the beach having a holiday and it's all just plots, plots, plots going on at the same time. You literally, do you do this? I literally to have dialogue going through my head for shows that don't even exist, for characters that don't, like, characters don't even fit anything yet. Just two people having tea and then she says this and he argues with her and she says no and then suddenly it gets very funny. That hasn't even got a show around it. It's just two people said, do you do that? I do all the time.
The closest thing I can relate it to people who aren't writers is I think it's that thing, you know, when you have an argument with someone and you leave it and then the next day you think of the perfect thing you could have said and you find yourself walking the street almost saying it out loud, like mouthing it. Yes, that's what it's like to be a writer, I think, that you're going all the time. What is that called?
That's called esprit de l'escalier, which is spirit of the staircase. It's a French phrase, meaning the moment you leave the room and go down the stairs, you go, oh, I should have said this. I should have said that. Esprit de l'escalier. That's posh. There we go.
Do you, because I also find with myself, I am happiest when there is a new idea, a new thing that I'm then obsessing about and thinking about and thinking, and if there ever isn't, I'm probably depressed. You go, what's wrong? Because I'm not creating a new thing at the moment.
Yes, that's true. I don't really have times when there isn't because I might not be creating a new thing, but that couple having an argument about their tea is still going, or that man who was an argument at a bus stop, or and some of these characters have been thinking of like for years, and one day I think I'll find a show they'll all fit into. But it never really stops. It doesn't really go. To be honest, I mean, that's not up days and down days like anyone else, but there's never a day when they shut up, really.
And do you find something I think is interesting in your stuff, definitely true of Years and Years, definitely true of It's a Sin, and crew of Queer as Folk, you seem drawn to and very, very good at, I did write to you about this, that you're very, very good at big group scenes, lots of characters. You have two characters. I find writing two characters talking to each other is easy. You do 10 characters, 8 characters, and they all have distinct personalities. They're all characters. They're all funny together. You know, you rattle through.
I love those scenes. Yeah. They're exhausting, those scenes. In a way, it's kind of like just setting yourself a test that it's the hardest thing to write. Mm-hmm. And because no one can take a back seat, but you can't have all 8 talking at once.
Yeah.
And everyone's got to wait their turn and everyone's got to be unique. I mean, days like that, I walk into this room. It's like, that's like heavyweight fighting. I'm like literally like flexing my muscles and sitting and going, I also know I can do it. But also that goes hand in hand with the fear that I won't do it this time, that it'll go wrong. So, I love those scenes. I kind of set those scenes up to keep myself spinning, really. Yeah.
It's a real, and it's a gift. I've told you this, but and it's a sin. Oh. I think it's 10 minutes for us to fall in love with everyone. Oh. It's like 10 minutes. And we're like, I love everyone. I know everyone and I love everyone.
That's a miracle of casting, that show, though. It is a miracle of casting, that show. I mean, I have to admit myself, something magic happened with that show. You hope that'll happen on every show you ever make. Mm. And I'm not saying I miscast anything else, but just sometimes that thing comes along. I think you did it. We were just talking before we started recording about Ted Lasso. I think sometimes something happens and something goes bazing in a way you could never plan for. And it did with that cast. It's like, bless them. Love them. Love them.
Okay, two more love things I'm going to love you with. One is, I think the scene, no spoilers, if you haven't seen It's a Sin, you have by now, but it's fucking phenomenal. But the scene on the bridge in the final episode is top 10 scenes in TV history of all time for many, many reasons. And one of them, I think it's so shocking. It's such a shock and it's so brilliant because it's the thing we've been building towards this whole season. And then you do something else.
Those three words that come bang. But actually, there's a reason why that works, was that with me writing dialogue in my head all the time, I always knew that was coming. From page one of episode one, I knew that was coming. So I had 5 months of writing that thing to build up to. It's no wonder it works, because I've been promising that to the production team. I go, wait till you get to the end. Wait till you get to the end. This is brilliant scene. Wait till you get to the end. So everyone had been promised that moment. Again, it's like setting yourself a challenge. It's like, so I had to meet that challenge. Right. We'd be promising Keely Halls, like, honestly, please come and do this part. Well, she accepted the part before that was written. Oh, and in all the other episodes, she's got like just 10 lines. Yeah. It's honestly, Keely, honestly, it'll pay off in the last episode. Honestly. And that's the opposite of 8 people in the scene. That's probably my favorite thing to write, actually. It's just 2 people, two people talking to each other, ripping their souls open. The two of them, like, wow, oh that's
and wow. The, so will you say Thank you had you. The ending. How often have you got the whole thing, you know, where your end is? How often have you written something where you don't know how it ends and you're working it out as you go?
I kind of always know how it ends, always. It's always something to, it might change, but I can't think of a time when it does change. Actually, that's not the end. You know, there's another 10 minutes after that. But actually, I knew those scenes as well. I kind of never know the middle. And I know where to begin, I know what the ending is, and I've got like 10 poles all the way through then that you kind of swing between. But the ending, it just gives you hope. I can't imagine sitting here thinking, I don't know the end. That must be the most horrific feeling. True. So, hopefully I've got something I'm going to write next year, which is 5 episodes long. And I literally know, again, that ends on 3 words. Great 3 words. Bang, 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 like that. So it's just good knowing,
Okay, and the last love thing, although I'm sure I'll do loads more, but the last love thing is, I
love the love.
People who always ask for advice on writing, I tell them to watch one episode of Doctor Who, which is called Midnight. I think is a fucking creative masterpiece. It's essentially a bottle episode. It's mostly all set in one room on a stalled spaceship, and it has almost no special effects. And within it, it contains all of philosophy about human nature. It has a genuinely terrifying idea that is done without any special effects. It's fucking scary. It's incredibly moving. It's sad. It's powerful. And it ends, it's haunting, and it's 40 minutes?
Yeah, 40 minutes, 45.
And it's an entire new cast of characters. I mean, you're a genius.
Shall I kill you, Brett, and tell you I wrote that in 3 days?
I love that you wrote that. No, it makes me happy that you did that. I think you're channeling. You're channeling.
Looking at your deadlines now, you're really glad to hear that. Yes, please. Please, you can.
Yeah.
Cast. Look at that cast. David Tennant and Leslie Sharp. Actually, everyone in that cast. Lindsay Coulson. Oh, God, all of them. Colin, fantastic cast. Every single one of them. Very lucky.
You're very good. So...
Thank you.
But, Russell.
What?
I've forgotten to tell you something.
What?
Maybe I should have told you this first and then done all the love stuff, because maybe it would have sort of cushioned the blow, but I should have. I probably should have told you at the beginning. I forgot. Because I was just so excited to see you, but I probably should have pointed it out. Ugh, I'm going to kick myself. You've died.
Oh, mate.
I know.
I've got so much more to write.
I know. You're one of the people I've wanted to kill the least.
I'm not ready. And do you know what? British television will just carry on. That's the truth.
It will be barren. It will be a barren landscape.
I want BBC One with a black border for a whole month. Thank you very much.
How did you die, Russell?
Well, actually, now you mention it, and there's a reason behind this. I actually fell down the stairs and broke my neck. That's terrible, isn't it?
Horrific.
And that really hurts. That's like nasty. And the reason why this is ironic, it's an ironic death, was like round about 25 years ago, I read How to Save Your Life When You Fall Downstairs, How Not to Break Your Neck, which is to splay your arms and legs out wide, because that jams you in the stairwell. But no one ever does it, because when you fall, your automatic instinct is to kind of curl up, bang, 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 10, 20 steps, you've broken your neck, you're dead. And the most interesting thing about this is that I tell everyone this, Brett. I am that boring person that goes, did you know if ever you fall downstairs? So the hilarity at my funeral of everyone I know going, well, can you imagine that he actually fell downstairs and didn't follow the advice he's been giving people for 25 years? There would be... rolling in the aisles, frankly, and the people will be dusting their hands like they do in cartoons, going, there we are, that's his fault.
Of course you're not going to put your hands out. You've got to protect your face. Yeah,
you don't. I know. Yes, that's what, apparently, honestly, it's true. You don't do it, and that's why you die. And if you just, if I can help anyone out there from the afterlife, where I'm speaking now, if I can help anyone, do the star jump as you fall. Why? Wow. Splay. Splay, and you could save your life.
Splay. That voice in your head as you're falling, splay.
Splay. It would be incredible if someone, as they fell downstairs, their first instinct would be to remember my words. I think you'd have to be quite an odd person to think, oh, Russell T. Davis.
Riddle me this. How much do you worry about death, may I ask?
I'm actually quite morbid. I think a lot of writers are. I think all writers are. I think we're all writing. I think we're all creating to fend off death. I'm genuinely morbid. When I was a little kid, when I was about 3 years old, and I've got two older sisters, and when my parents would go out, if they were like 5 minutes late coming back, my older sister would stand at the window going, I think they're dead. I think there's been a car crash, and they're dead. It was like her thing. It was her thing. Yeah. And so I was brought up with that. If anyone's late, if anyone doesn't turn up, they're dead. And I kind of, I'm not kidding. I kind of like, if I get into a car or a taxi, there's a little bit of me thinking, I wonder if this is the journey that'll kill me. Is that just me? No. I really do.
That's not just you, but
kind of constant. It's a constant little tick in my head. And one day I'll be going, there it is. I'm right. Splay.
Splay.
Yeah. So yes,
my sister certainly has death, but only for herself. It's like, oh, she's got a cold, she's gonna die always. Whatever it is, oh, I cut myself, that must be cancer, I'm gonna die. Oh, you just cut your finger.
This is the sister who I listen to your podcast. She sleeps too much, doesn't she? Or she loves sleep.
She loves sleep.
Yes, she loves sleep. Good.
Shout out to Tara. Hope you're having a lovely nap during this.
Well, is she real or is this a little bit Norman Bates? She's going to go and put on a wig. Here's my sister.
Well, no one's seen her, so let's just leave it at
that. Yeah, that's what I mean.
What do you think happens after you die? Do you think there's an afterlife? How do you feel
about
that?
No.
Really?
I absolutely nothing, and I know it. I just don't believe it. It's not a merely belief of mine. It's a fact. Let's not even play around here. There's nothing.
Nothing.
Of course there isn't. It's true. Do you know, us atheists are so polite, I've got to say. Yeah. And I'm going to stop being polite and stop putting... My husband died a couple of years ago, and it's like the amount of people who look me in the eye... You know, if I get something on telly or something nice happens to me, the amount of people who look me in the eye go, he's smiling down at you now, he's happy now. And I literally look at him, they're going, how the fuck do you dare think you know what he's doing better than I do? They say it right to your face.
Yeah.
And we're brought up in this Christian society that's really polite to people. Oh, thank you very much, like that. Someone's going to get a smack in the face one day when they say that to me.
That is a bold thing to say to you, actually.
All the time people say, and they're being really nice. It's a horrible thing to say. I'm a vile person. He'd be frowning at me now, Brad.
He's very disappointed.
Very disappointed at what I'm saying. It's such an arrogant thing to say to people. Honestly, check yourselves, people. Don't say it. It's rude.
Yeah. So having that as your base level, like, are you just at peace with that, I suppose? Does it not fill you with existential dread or like, oh, God?
Oh, my God. Look, it's kind of win-win, because if there is a heaven, I'm like, yay! It's like, imagine, I'll be the one like running down that valley of flowers, go, yeah, this is brilliant. But sadly, not at that time. I never thought my heaven is a valley full of flowers. I'm not sure where I got that from. It's like camp little heaven waiting for me.
Got that from What Dreams May Come, I think.
Yes.
Well, I tell you this, Russell T. Davis.
Yes.
There is a heaven, and it's a valley of flowers.
With a cinema.
There's definitely a cinema. There's a massive cinema.
The Valley of Flowers multiplex.
Yes.
Let's go there, Brett. That's Should we go there?
Let's go there, shall we? And in this heaven, by the way, for the record, the people of heaven, they're so nice that when you arrive, none of them are mad that you didn't believe. They're all like, hey,
wow, that's where you win. They have to forgive. That's like this Christianity.
They are actually delighted because they're massive fans. And they want to know about your life. They want to know about all your stuff. But they want to know about your life through film.
Yes.
Because it's heaven. And the first thing they ask you is, what's the first film you remember seeing? Russell T. Davies?
Yes. It's a bit of a blur because I'm back in the 60s. So there's like, was it Oliver? Was it Jungle Book? Whoa. But the trip to the cinema that I remember first was a trip, because I lived in Swansea and we went to Port Albert, which was a big trip. Went to Port Albert to see a double bill of Ring of Bright Water and Carry On Camping.
Wow.
That's quite a double bill, isn't it? That's really quite something. It's like one in which an otter is butchered to death in front of you, and then Barbara Windsor gets her breasts out. That's like, it probably explains my whole life.
No wonder you don't believe in God. I mean, that's...
No wonder I don't believe in women. It's like, what a strange upbringing. What a double bill. I love double bills. And if you think about it, I'd love to see Ring of Bright Water again now, because I haven't seen it since. And like, you know, it's about a cute animal, but like cats are cute, and dogs are cute, and Baby Yoda is cute. An otter?
Yeah.
What does that film look like? Do they actually make that otter cute? And it's not like he dies saving your life. He doesn't, you know, go on the brake pedal of the car, or he doesn't warn you that a landslide's coming. He's just trotting along in a ditch and a man picks up a spade and clubs his head in. It's like, what is that film saying?
That's your first film. That's awful.
When I said I was obsessed with death, and then we watched Carry On Camping, all asses must be shown.
What a contrast. Did you go with your family, with your sisters, who also
My mum took that with my two sisters. It was a special little trip out. Why that was in Port Talbot when Swansea was full of cinemas. I literally that's lost in the mists of time, but it must have been a double bill that attracted my mother enormously. Like, here we go, let's go.
Do you remember, like, I meant to ask you this earlier, but it applies with this. You are a writer. You are a writer. You are sort of a born writer. Do you remember when you were little, like when you watched films, were you like, this is what I want to do, this storytelling? Or were you like, do you remember it starting?
Kind of. That's a very Doctor Who-y thing, to be honest. That was, and I think it's true of, what's a great big wasp in the room with me. It's an annoying one. It's really annoying on podcasts where people say things like that. Like when Adam Buxton talks to his dogs. Stop talking to your dogs. Talk to me. So Doctor Who's the thing for that. That's those are the first stories I started to write. That's when actually you become a writer. You think, oh, the Daleks invade my street, and this happens and that happens. Yeah. So that's not a cinema thing for me. That's TV.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, love it very much.
What is the film that made you cry the most? Are you a crier?
Oh, big time. Like I cried the Go Compare advert when he goes, "It's me." Like, of course it's you.
It's very
of course
moving.
It's your voice. It's me. And so literally terrible cry. But no, love, not terrible. I'm happy to cry at anything. Yeah. I am that audience. In real life, you could probably be clubbed down in front of me and I'd look at you with a glassy, impassive face. But when it comes to fiction, the thing that first upset me, and not just made me cry, but upset me, is The Towering Inferno, a truly great film, when Jennifer Jones falls out the scenic elevator.
Wow.
That's a cruel. She's Fred Astaire's girlfriend, and she's saved a deaf woman. There's a deaf woman, and she saved a deaf woman. So you kind of think she's safe. You think, and she's middle-aged as well. She's not like that, she's like that middle-aged guy. You think she'll be safe. She gets in a scenic elevator with Faye Dunaway. They're on the 100th floor. There's an explosion. The wires snap. And it's such a cruel death because an extra knocks the panel of glass out of the lift. The extra, I would love to find this woman. She's got it coming. The extra gets out the way. She gets out the way. She's saved. So Jennifer Jones just falls right through the open gap and falls 100 floors to her death. That is really... And it honestly upset me. I looked up what date this was. I was 11 when I saw this. So I'm old enough to know that she's not really dead. But actually, it really kind of, on some profound level, it really tackled me. I went and saw it with my mum and dad as well, so I didn't like to cry in front of them, so that was embarrassing.
Yeah.
And then I can remember going home, like, really? I knew she wasn't really dead. I remember watching the credits, I knew her name was Jennifer Jones. It's like, right, she's Jennifer Jones. Of course, there was no internet to look up there. I couldn't look up the internet to find out she was living in LA quite happily and appearing in Fulton Crest or something. So I was genuinely, it upset me so much, I felt like she died. And I needed some sort of reassurance that she hadn't, that never came. Did I tell you I'm obsessed with death? It's like...
Yeah, you're obsessed with death. But it's also, that is what's interesting, that is another kind of, that it's a cruel, godless death. She'd done good. This woman had done good. And then... She still died.
I love disaster movies for that. I love the Poseidon Adventure. It's those 70s ones are brilliant and never matched, I think. I love them. Shelley Winters in the Poseidon Adventure die. That's fantastic. Actually, they always kill off the middle-aged woman, don't they?
Yeah. I love that you've still got a vendetta against the extra.
Who was she? She's probably a stunt woman, bless her. But it's like, because I literally have slowed it down on VHS since and watched it. Going, it's that woman. It's that woman's fault. Oh, it's cruel. Cruel. You could have lost Faye Dunaway. Who'd have missed her? No one.
Yeah. And you are very good at writing and cry things that make you cry. I mean, your Doctor Who's, I think I cried every week.
I did love the old tears there. Well, it was just, it's so full-blooded, Doctor Who, isn't it? It's like, it's so much fun. You've got to kind of balance the fun with a bit of that as well. It's just all emotion, really. It's just, if it wasn't that full-blooded, then you're just looking at laser beams.
Yeah.
You know, there's no point otherwise. Happy days.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series. You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with Hacks writer and actor Pat Regan, on how their improv experience helped them when shooting scenes and what it was like writing scripts for specific actors.
You'll also hear from crew members like the costume designers on what it was like creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Hear stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and more. Watch Hacks streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, you're also good at scaring people. What's the film that scared you the most?
Okay, it's pretty... I hovered over Trilogy of Terror with Karen Black. That's a very good film. But actually, it's The Exorcist, the good old-fashioned Exorcist, because I saw that. I didn't see it on its first release, but it was I saw it in the Juxon Street Cinema in Oxford, like two nights before my finals when I was a student. And obviously now you laugh at finals. They don't matter at all, kids. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how you do at the time.
They're very important, actually.
They're your whole world. I mean, two nights before, it's like... Yeah. So it was absolutely the wrong mood to go and see a film like that in, because it really got to me. It, you know, now you kind of laugh at The Exorcist and all the makeup on Linda Blair's face. And also, now every other film is like The Exorcist. You forget when I was 18 that you didn't have films full of explosions and aliens and demons and monsters. It's like they were still rare. And there'd never been anything like that. So it's religiosity got to me. It's watching a film in which, you know, actually devils are real. And yeah, I remember I went home that night and I was properly disturbed by it. I wasn't just scared.
Yeah.
It really got to me. I thought it was just that capacity to think, imagine if that world existed. That first, you know, that first half hour of the film before you get to Linda Blair, where are you? Israel or somewhere? Or Libya?
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah.
And it's all the strange people pass by, people with a blind eye, and a clock stops. Do you remember the scene where a clock is going tick-tock and it just suddenly stops? It's so unnerving and it so brilliantly sets that up. It's like, weirdly, that was my husband's favourite film, as in his favourite film.
Really?
Full stop. How can that be your favourite film? He was nuts, wasn't he? He'd like, he had a day off work, he'd watch that on a Tuesday afternoon. I'd say, what did you do this afternoon? Oh, I watched The Exorcist. He'd go, you did what? It's like, it's not a film widely passed a couple of hours. Oh, yes, barely a month go by without him digging out that DVD.
Wow.
It's not funny.
A cup of tea in The Exorcist.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Do you like, I'm not putting this on you. Do you like horror films generally?
Yes, yes. I do. I love them. And I'll kind of, you know, I'll go through that. I'm that rubbish viewer. I'll go through the list on Sky. We know we've got nothing to watch.
Yeah.
And there's those Sky movies like The Deadly Vault, you know, and it's and you read the billing and it says a woman goes home after 20 years to find out why her parents died, only to discover that a demon is possessed. That I mean, and they're rubbish, you know. It says 2 stars. It's got people in it you've never heard of, but that's my Tuesday afternoon. Oh my God, no wonder I married my husband. It's I've just realised that I'm choosing to spend my Tuesday afternoons with worse films than The Exorcist.
As if you're trying to make a point.
Oh my God, I've just unraveled myself. But I am, or you know, 10 o'clock at night on a Wednesday. If tonight, if there's nothing on, I'd be like, oh, let's watch, you know, The Evil Cellar. And there's so many of them.
On the double bill with The Deadly Vault.
There are so many of them on Sky. It's just, you know, you get your big movies on Sky, and then there's an endless list of rubbish. And there I am, somewhere in LA, you know, there, someone's bank account just going, ping, $2. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Russell.
Who was that?
What is the film that people don't really like? It's not critically acclaimed, but you love it the most, other than The Evil Cellar.
Yeah. I found this question, because we are faithful listeners, we are sent these questions in advance, just to blow the whole film out. In advance. And I find this kind of tricky. It's like, say it again.
It's a film that you really love with all your heart, but it's a film that most people think is shit. Basically,
I've had a hard time thinking of this one. I've got a film that I really love that everyone's forgotten.
Go on.
Will that do?
Yeah, I'll take that.
No Way Out. Kevin Costner.
Sean Young.
Kevin Costner. Gene Hackman.
Sex in a Limo.
Oh, is the Sex in a Limo? I just remember that the plot twist. If you haven't seen it, spoiler of the...
Sadly, I remember the Sex in the Limo, which tells us how our brains work. You're like, the plot the twist is great. I'm like, yeah, Sex in a Limo.
But that's quite a forgotten film. No one ever says, oh, I love No Way Out. I remember watching that going, it's a great thriller. The twist, Brett, which you've forgotten, is brilliant. It's a huge cinematic twist that like no one does often enough. It's brilliant.
The twist is the limo isn't moving.
Twist is that wasn't sex, Brett. What are you thinking? That's not really answering your question, is it?
I'll take
all
it.
Services. Okay. Good. Actually, it might make some people go and watch that film, and it's a great film.
That's lovely.
And they'll get to that twist, and they'll be like, oh, my God. Actually, now I've ruined the twist, because you'd be three quarters of the way through going, well, nothing's twisted. Therefore, the only possible twist is. So I'm like, never mind. Yeah.
Well, you've saved us some time. What is the film that you used to love? You used to love it very much, and then you've watched it recently, and your feelings for it have changed for whatever reason that may be.
Yeah. This is a tricky one because I'm going to say, and it technically in itself, it's a great film, and no one meant any harm at the time. It's The Lost Boys, actually, which
Go
is
on.
A great film. But now you have to watch that with the history of Corey Haim and Corey Feldman, which is the film's kind of ruined. And I'm that sound makes it, even that conversation makes it sound like their fault. And it's not their fault. It's certainly not Corey Haim's fault. It's it's go and look them up if you don't know the history of. And again, I don't want to get you legally in trouble, supposed sexual abuse, which I'm sure happened. Not on that film, but in those people's lives. It's, you know, it's a story of two young kids in Hollywood, and the story of Corey Haim and Corey Feldman is a very sad story and shocking and really profoundly shocking and undoubtedly true. And that film is a great film, but it's just infected by your knowledge of the world that they were living in at the time. And actually, no one's ever said there was any abuse on that film, as far as I know. It's a shame because it's a beautiful, the ending, the music, Joel Schumacher at his best. It's just great, but kind of spoiled, really spoiled by real life, you know.
Yeah. Tell me this. What is the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily the film itself is any good, but because the experience you had around seeing the film will always make it special for you.
That's a tricky one, isn't it? It's, there's a few. There was the time I went to see Disney's Beauty and the Beast, the animated version, obviously. It's a great one. And I was all alone in the cinema. And that was magnificent. That was like a Tuesday afternoon. And my God, to see a film, you realize how much the bodies in the cinema soak up the sound, because when there's no one there, the storm was going, I was being knocked out of my chair, and also you can cry more and you can laugh more and you can enjoy. When the cutlery all starts singing, I gasped out loud. I was like, oh my God, like that, like you would never do if you were sitting with other people.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I loved that. That was a great, but actually anything, then the opposite end of that is I was in America on July the 4th, when Independence Day came out. And I love that film. I love that film. Exactly. I can't, people now kind of love it ironically, like, oh, it's rubbish. It's not. It's fantastic, that film.
So good.
It's great. But actually to see that, and it was so popular, and this happens quite a lot now, but this was, in these days, this never happened. There were like screenings 24 hours. So I got into like a 1 a.m. screening full of 1,000 people who were just cheering and blowing up the aliens. And also, genuinely, it's laughing at jokes that you don't get on your own necessarily. There's a moment night with the young lad sitting in a truck at night with his girlfriend, and he's trying to sleep with her because the alien's coming. It's like, you watch that on your own, and that's kind of fairly corny. Watch that with like 500 frat boys who are laughing so much at those jokes. And actually, they're laughing at themselves with the frat boy trying to get laid. It was just joyous. It's like that's how those films should be seen. Maybe all those films should always be seen with 1,000 people cheering. Yeah. And then you realise that, I mean, all right, it's very gung-ho and militaristic. But now, fuck off, those aliens are trying to kill us. It's blow them up.
What did you want us to do? Chat to them? They didn't have mouths.
And people sit there going, how is the computer, how is Jeff Goldblum's computer compatible with the aliens at the end? You go, all right, then let's have a version which it isn't. And we all die. What do you want, for God's sake? What do you want these films to be? Shut up.
I love that film. That is two perfect answers. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What is the, here we go. Is something, here we go, Russell. What's the sexiest film you've ever seen?
Well, now, it's undoubtedly, it's My Beautiful Laundrette. It's those two having sex in that film, which is, it's an astonishingly sexy scene. But it would be an astonishingly sexy scene now and at the time. And I love the fact that, as far as I'm aware, that film like wasn't sold as a gay film, gay romance. No, and it's not, I mean, I'm not just like, obviously I'm liking it because it's gay, but I also like the fact that Shirley Ann Field is in the other room. And I've always thought that's lacking from my sex life completely. Shirley Ann Field should always be in the other room, not knowing what's going on. I mean, and Jenny, there's the most beautiful woman in the world in the, and she's beautiful, Shirley Ann Field, in the other room. There's so many layers to that, and it's so undramatic, but at the same time, it's, there's like pouring champagne over each other, aren't they, or something? Are they swigging champagne? Yeah, so it's So it's kind of working class and down to earth, but there's champagne and it's, oh, it's properly sexy. That brilliant scene. Brilliant.
That's right. There's a subcategory to this question. The subcategory is troubling boners, worrying wide-ons. A film you found arousing that you weren't sure you were meant to.
You see, now that's a thing of the past for me now. I'm 58 this year, Brett. It's all gone. But looking back, thank God, the devil is off my shoulder. But looking back to when you were 14,
mm-hmm.
and can you see where I'm going? When I was 14, when you shag a letterbox at 14, and when that's 1977, you can see where I'm going. It's like, and this is never spoken about enough, actually. What exactly happened on the Millennium Falcon between Han Solo and Luke Skywalker? Because it was happening. I'm telling you now, I'm a writer. I've written those scenes. They were banging away like Billy-O. And it's like, and I don't know if there's much slash fiction about those two, but in my head at 14, that was, and actually it's genuinely before the whole world fell in love with Harrison Ford and
right.
before Star Wars became what it was. To me, obviously it was a brilliant film and I loved it, but actually it was about, I mean, Han Solo's got like buckles across his groin. They knew. Yes. And Han Solo's got a little, and Luke's got a little skirt across his groin. It's like, I could write essays on the representation of the groin in cinema. And they knew on that film what they were doing. Buckles, skirts.
Buckles and skirts.
Happening. All happening.
Absolutely mm-hmm. fascinating. I yep. really would read your essays for the record. Yep. So
I'll make that Star Wars film one.
This is your
Can
pitch.
You imagine?
I like that. Excellent. Objectively, Russell, objectively,
yes.
What's the greatest film of all time?
I'm going to say Back to the Future.
Delightful.
That must get said a lot. Has that been said before on your 5,000 podcast before you got round to me?
Do you know what? They were all just practice for being said properly now.
I do love it. I think it's just about, it's great big blockbustery. It's funny. It's so fun. That's yes, like, all. Oh, and it's so much of the humor's gone out of blockbusters these days. Bring the, it's the, we used to laugh at them. Actually, Marvel has a fair old level of humor mm-hmm. in them, but they used to be properly fun. And do you know my favorite thing about that film? I do love blockbuster films. I love fantasy films. I love great big high concept stuff like that. And it's a film without a villain. There is no enemy in that film except time. There's the school bully, there's Biff, yeah. but he just, and actually I don't think it works in the second one where he becomes villain. He gets yeah. villainous. You're like going, no, he's just Biff, he's an idiot. And he gets in the way of the plot. He punches someone at the wrong time just to hold you up, but just to hold you up against the greater villain, which is time. Yeah. You have simply got to get to that town hall as that lightning bolt strikes in that car. The whole thing is a work of genius. I can remember sitting in the cinema in Cardiff. I saw that in Cardiff for the first time. And the days when there were smoking areas in the cinemas on the left, so I was sitting on the left, smoking away, sitting there thinking, this film is perfect. And it is. It yeah. still is, I think.
And it's also, I went, when we had the like week between lockdowns, where there was like that week where it was hey, and then it went lockdown again. I wanted to go to the cinema, but they weren't putting any new films out. And so Back to the Future was on. So I went and watched it. And I hadn't watched it properly, and I watched it big screen. I hadn't watched it properly.
Still good?
Still really, really good. But what's fascinating about it, I guess, for me, is it's also very weird for a big, you know, blockbuster film. It's incredibly unique in ways that you sort of go, I don't know that you would have got notes from execs. Like, there's you know, it's about a mum trying to sleep with her son.
Yes, and that's odd. Yeah.
There's this weird kind of, there's a lot of, men have to punch people. there's this weird subplot with plutonium and Marty has this friendship with this older man that's never, and by the way, all of it works and it's amazing and it's very satisfying and brilliant, but it's weird. It's quite weird when you look
Do the terrorists look a bit dodgy now? Are they it's Libyans or Syrians or something dodgy?
That's a question. Yeah. That's a question.
Yes. Like, yes.
I live in the air.
Never mind.
but it's like quite adult.
They'd be Proud Boys now, wouldn't they? They'd just be Proud Boys. That'd bring down the capital. That'd be a much better version.
Yeah.
Oh, but it's great, isn't it?
But it's so good.
I can remember the moment of the cables come undone and the lightning bolts on its way and Dog has to swing all the way down. I literally remember sitting there going, well, that's perfect.
Yeah.
That is every part of the plot is character. That fits his character. Yeah. That fits the time. That fits the hope you have. Oh, what a film. What a film.
great film.
Also, pretty sexy Michael J. Fox. Very nice. Lovely. Beautiful.
There you go. And relatable workaholic was making Family Ties at the same time.
Yep, absolutely.
Probably very tired on his skateboard. Doesn't show it.
Back to Future 3 is good as well. I'm also fond of 2. People love 2. I don't love 2. 3 is great as well. Yeah.
3 is good. What's the film that you can or have watched the most over and over again?
Well, it's funny, this one, because it's not one. I mean, I have seen Star Wars a million times, and if Independence Day is on, I'll watch that. It's actually, the one I can never turn away from is Remains of the Day, which if ever that's on, you know, and it'll crop up on Film 4 or, you know, late night on Channel 4, and you think, oh, I'll just have a look at this. And once I've seen one scene, I cannot look. I mean, that's a perfect film. I actually could have chosen. It's a perfect book, and it's a perfect film of a perfect book. And I mean, perfect. And I think it's just it's so understated that, you know, the repression of that lead character. I can remember reading that book. I was on a holiday in Paris on my own, and I was sitting in this park and I was crying my eyes out reading the book. I love it. And so you can watch Anthony Hopkins do any scene in that film not saying what he's thinking. And I think that's why you can't look away. It's because of the silence of it, the unsaidness of it, and then Emma Thompson's face at the on her last shot as that bus or tram pulls away is just I cry more at that than Jennifer Jones falling out the lift. And I love it. So weirdly, I find myself watching it. It could be halfway through when I go, oh look, Remains of the Day is on. Bang! An hour later, I'm still there. Love it.
One of the other, I'm giving you one more love thing. One of my other favorite things that you ever wrote was the ending of Donna in Doctor Who. It's how that story completes is one of the most saddest things I've ever seen. And in that, what happens, no spoilers, but what David Tennant has to do is not reveal anything. Like that. That's your Remains of the Day.
Yeah, that's my Remains of the Day. It just had Daleks and Davros in it.
Yeah.
Which, let's face it, would have improved Remains of the Day.
I'd much rather watch that. Truthfully.
I'll take that compliment gladly.
Now, we don't like to be negative, but what's the worst film you've ever seen?
This is negative because I love it so much I could talk about it forever. So just prepare yourself for a long podcast. You know the film When a Stranger Calls?
Yes.
When a Stranger Calls is the call is coming from inside the house.
Yes.
A classic. The sequel, which I thought was called When a Stranger Calls 2, but it's called When a Stranger Calls Back.
Yes.
Do you know this film?
You know, weirdly, not to a podcast guest before you, but was that Andy Nyman? Andy Nyman texted me and said, you have to watch When a Stranger Calls Back, and I have
watched it. Oh, you have watched it?
I have watched it.
Oh, my God. But isn't it? So let me just describe the basics now. There's a babysitter in a house. There's a knock at the front door, and there's a man's voice going, hello, hello, my car's broken down. Can you let me in, please? Oh, I can't let anyone in. I'm looking after 2 children. No, please let me in. Please. And it turns out that the murderer is standing behind her because he's painted himself the same color as the wall. That's not the funniest bit. He's painted himself the same color as the wall, but he is a professional ventriloquist. So he's throwing his voice to make it sound as though it's coming from outside the door. And this is my favorite thing. And this, I tell this story an awful lot because you must have had this happen in your career. It's like there must have been 100 people on set that day, let alone the fact that script had been to 100 people. And then there's 100 costume standing there and continuity and props and carpenters and electricians. Everyone standing there thinking, that's not how ventriloquism works. You don't literally throw your voice so it sounds like it's coming from the other side of the door. She's got her back to where the man with the voice is. And yet the entire film supposes that you actually throw your voice. No one said so. Haven't you been in things where something's gone wrong and like literally a prop's been wrong or a stage direction's been wrong and no one says anything? I love that. I'm one sitting in the edit going afterwards going, why did no one say anything? Why did no one point this out? And that film, how many people were on set that day?
Yeah.
Going, that's out, let alone the fact that he paints himself the same color as the wall,
yeah.
which is
Which he wouldn't have known. What he had to get in the house, either will bring various paints with him.
Yes, various paints, because I think he moves rooms. Yeah. There's one fantastic shot where there's just a wall, and then you see his eyes open. He's standing against the wall. It really is staggeringly bad, that. Staggeringly. Isn't it nuts? Oh, I'm so glad you've seen it. No one else has ever seen it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hooray. You can get it on Amazon Prime.
Highly recommend it. Oh, really recommend it, because it's like, he paints him. How does he find out the color of the wall? He must do some research, mustn't he?
I did think about that, and I've also wondered, like, because the thing that always bothers me about painting yourself into the wall is fine, I don't object to it, but you have to hold a mirror. There's no one there to tell him, yes, you're in the right spot of the stripes, or
and a very specific piece of wall, I would think. It's like, it's not just, you know, it's not a corner. It's like you have to stand right there. Yeah. And it's pretty tricky to murder someone when you're having to pretend to be a wall.
And you're also covered in paint. And also, the other thing is, you probably smell like paint. You ain't been there long.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
She's going, very painty smell in here.
And I would imagine throwing your voice takes some concentration. So his mind's not even on that. He's like thinking, hello, my car's broken down outside. he's putting his heart and soul into, like, hello, can you help me? Can you open the door? Also, he also has to go nowhere where there's glass in the front door. Yeah. Or it's blown. It's like, I can only murder babysitters in houses that have completely wooden doors.
Wooden doors. It's, and when I'm throwing that voice, he's throwing it over the babysitter, through the door.
But they don't actually throw them.
Listen, that's what, if we've called it that, we say that for a reason. That's what I think is that the writer read Ventriloquist. Maybe never seen a ventriloquist, just read.
How many people on that film thought they throw their voices? How many? It's about, I once did a drama where, and I better not name names, but where there was a lift and we couldn't afford a lift. It's an old-fashioned grill lift. So we'll do the lift with lights. You know, if you're going down, the lights are going up on your face. And if you're going up, the lights are going down on your face. So this woman gets in the lift and the lights go the wrong way. She's going up and the lights go the wrong way. The lights go up, which means she's going down. Now, this lift is very clearly in the basement. I'm sitting there in the edit going, well, she's on a lift to hell, isn't she? She's going down into hell. And I maintain 60 people stood on set and no one said, those lights are going the wrong way. That happens a lot, though, doesn't it, on set?
It does happen a lot.
And no one has the nerve to pipe up.
Yeah, no, it's like you're not the boss, so you have to go, well, maybe they know what they're doing. Maybe
that's something. It. That they think there's something, I don't know, there's some reason for this.
I don't want to be stupid and go, why are the lights going? And they go, because it's art, because actually in her mind she's going downstairs or something. And you go, oh, sorry, I didn't understand the script.
But ventriloquism? Really? Oh, I love that film.
That's great. Great. Now, you are very funny, Russell, and you've written lots of stuff that's very funny. What's the film that made you laugh the most?
It is probably, I think, South Park, Bigger, Longer, Uncut.
It's a great film.
Also, it's a great film. That's the thing. Film. Now, that I cried at the end of that film, where Kenny saves the world. Yeah, literally. And that film works like a blockbuster in ways that modern blockbusters don't work well enough anymore. Yeah. And all the gears clicking, all the hydraulics go boom, 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 and give you a happy ending. And, you know, it had a song called Blame Canada that was nominated for Best Oscar, and Robin Williams sang it at the Oscars, Blame Canada. But it's properly funny, that thing.
It's a genuinely brilliant musical as well.
Yeah, the songs are brilliant. Everything's brilliant in it. Yeah. It's a properly great film.
Very
love
good shout. Russell T. Davis, you've been such a dream delight.
The best ever? I'm calling it.
For anyone who else has been on a podcast, who's listened to this, please mute. Please turn it off for a second.
Yes, of course.
You can do it like a ventriloquist. Yes, the voice.
That wasn't me. That was someone from their voice.
That was the wall.
That was my Muppet poster just talking. What I will say is, when you were headed down the stairs, it was a big staircase, you were just heading down the stairs, and you tripped, and you fell, you went, slay, slay, and then you were like, no, not slay, what was the word?
Splay.
By the time you'd realised it was splay, not slay, you had connected with the stairs, your arms were curled inside you.
You were slayed.
You broke your neck at the end. Like, it was quite a lot of, it was quite nasty as it went down. I'm really sorry. You actually hit the stairs about 30 or 40 times. before you break your neck, and then when you break your neck, it was instant then, but it was pretty brutal in the way. Anyway, I was walking around looking for you. I was like, where's Russell? I ain't seen Russell in a while. I wonder where Russell is. And I was carrying my coffin, you know what I'm like. Yeah. And I knock on your door, your door's open. Because you're very trusting. You just don't lock your door. So I walk
I'm
in
all
and
trust.
I see your broken neck body at the bottom of the stairs. I'm devastated because, you know, I like you and stuff, but you're dead.
Yeah,
and foxes have eaten you because you left the door open. Foxes have eaten bits of you. They'd laid eggs because, you know, foxes lay eggs. And
I know.
Stuff had been growing in your carcass.
Moss
was there. Little fox.
Bracken.
There was more of you than I was expecting, is the point. So
I'm 6 foot six. There's a lot of me.
Yeah. And on telly, you look 6 foot four. So I'd actually brought a coffin that was 6 foot four, forgetting that there was the extra 2 inches. Anyway, I get your axe. You know, you've got that axe. And I get it from your kitchen where you use to cut up your dinner. And I get the axe. And I have to chop up your bones, make it smaller, right? Chop up all the bits. Put it in the blender you have for your steaks and stuff. Put you in this coffin. It's rammed. There's very little room in this coffin. There's so much more than I was expecting. There was only enough room in this coffin for me to slip one DVD into the side, for you to take to the other side. And on the other side, it's movie night every night. And one night, it's your movie night. What film are you taking to show everyone in heaven when it's your movie night? Russell T. Davies.
All right, I will take Return of the Jedi. Because it gets updated every 10 years. So every 10 years, it'll have something new added to it. In another 10 years, it'll be 4D. It'll move through time, sort of space. It's like, thank you, Lucas Empire. I will.
That is a lovely, lovely choice. Russell, is there anything other than your magnificent back catalogue, is there anything coming up or you would like people to look out for, to listen to, or to watch?
You know, there isn't. Well, there is, but it's not kind of announced that I'll have something on ITV at the end of next year. That's what ITV, yes. And there's a reason it has to be on ITV. And that's all I'm saying.
What? Because it needs ad breaks? What?
What's
the secret?
Please watch.
I will. I love you.
Oh, I love you. I've loved this. Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this. And
the best.
I hope you have a lovely... thank you for doing this.
The best.
And I hope you have a lovely death. Good day to you, sir. And good night. Thank you.
God rest my soul, which does not exist.
Good night. So that was episode 149. Head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 25 minutes of chat, secrets and video with Russell. Go to Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star rating. But instead of writing about the show, write about a film that means the most to you and why. It's lovely to read and it helps our numbers and it means Maureen can stay drinking craft beer or whatever she's into this week. The big announcement, if you missed it, I will be doing a live Films to be Buried With at the Underbelly Festival in London on July the 3rd at 5:00 p.m. That is a live Films to be Buried With in a Spiegel tent. Come along. We'll have a right old time. I'll have an amazing guest. We'll do the show and then we'll do a Q&A and you can tell me the films that meant the most to you from the audience. We'll have a right old time. Come on, people together in a thing with ventilation. It'll be fun, I hope. Yeah, it will be. Come on. Get your tickets. Look online. Thank you very much. See you there. Thank you very much to Russell for doing the show. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lytham for the photography. Come and join me next week for another smashing guest. Oh yeah, you'll love it. I hope everyone is well. So that is it for now. In the meantime, have a lovely week. And please, now more than ever, be excellent to each other.
Sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind. Sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
Maureen, your Canva presentation looks brilliant. Thanks, Brett. That's because I used AI-powered Canva presentations. I just described what I wanted, and Canva presentations generated the perfect slides. You can even make a talking presentation for people to watch on their own time. Check this out. Recording. 101 Reasons Why Beaches is the Saddest Film Ever Made by your neighbour Maureen. Is it easy to use? If you can use a computer, you can nail your next work presentation with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work. Oh, thanks, my name is Maureen. Yeah, thank you.